Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Corner kick. Celtic couldn't handle Wood on the set piece. It's a brilliant header. And Cahill goes to spectacle. What about that? What about that? Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He's yeah! Gone. Australia got it.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Thank you for joining us for episode 41 of Shim, Spider, and so much more. Lots to get through again today, including the dreaded VAR, which reared its ugly head again at Cooper's Stadium on Friday. A riveting Sydney derby. There's the fan protests at Old Trafford in the Premier League. And our special guest is none other than Socceroos playing legend and former national team coach, Frank Farina. All that to come. But let's first welcome our boys from the Golden Generation, Craig Moore and Jelko Kalats. How are you guys? Are you good?
All good, boys. All good over here.
Enjoying watching the football at a reasonable hour, are you, Spider?
Mate, I tell you what, how good is it? You don't get up like a bastard in the morning and grind through the day. You go to bed after a cracking night's football, it's tops.
Cracking weekend's football in Scotland, Mr. Moore. Your Rangers team hammering Celtic by 4-1. Looks like they're going to have the unbeaten season. I looked at the players that they've got at the moment. How nice for Jermaine Defoe. He's 38 and he's just won his first league championship medal.
That's an amazing story. You look, you speak about Jermaine Defoe. Alan McGregor, I think, is 39 and has had a wonderful season. Also, Simon, although he's won a few more trophies. There's a few older players within. There's a good mix between youth and experience. Rangers were disappointing to not give themselves a possibility to go and do the double. They got knocked out of the cup by St. Johnstone through penalties, which was a huge, huge disappointment. But any Rangers supporter, Simon, you ask them at the start of the season, can they stop Celtic winning 10 in a row and win the league? This season, mate, 100%. That's what this season has been about. And they are looking as if they're going to go undefeated and break 100 points, which is incredible.
Job done. Okay, let's get into it then in Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, one of Australia's first live streaming companies operating since 2008. They focus on virtual and hybrid events, broadcasting to unlimited online audiences worldwide by either a secure private stream page or publicly on social media. Live streaming allows social online engagement as viewers are able to communicate back to the presenters in real time while social distancing. So should you require a small personal event or business level webcast, please go to streamgate.com.au or you can find them on Instagram. Well, boys, let's start with some off-field stuff here in Australia. Unfortunately, some trouble in the Rochdale against Sydney United clash last week, which we, I think, touched upon in last week's podcast. Which has brought out the usual dinosaurs in the Australian media. Football Australia, CEO James Johnson, going on air on radio to talk about the incident last week. And he ends up being hectored on the scrapping of the NCIP policy, which is rather interesting. Do you think that was a wise thing to do? Did he give a good account of himself? And the third part of that question is, why do we consistently have to defend ourselves against this? Not defending the trouble that happened because it was ugly, but why is it that our sport continually has to find itself on the end of these campaigns, it seems to me?
Well, first and foremost, I think James Johnson actually done a great job considering, what's the name of the guy that did the interview?
Ray Hadley.
Yeah, Ray Hadley obviously had an agenda and he was an absolute bully. He actually wouldn't let James talk. He kept on talking over the top of him. So why bring someone on if you're not going to let them speak? He had an agenda. It was simple as that, mate. At the end of the day, I think James done a good job in keeping his calm and presenting the situation that he did.
Maury?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, I didn't really hear the interview. I've seen, obviously, the media and all that sort of stuff. And I don't really like talking about it too much, Simon, because I'm thinking, why do we give these people oxygen? Why do we continue to give them the publicity that they want? We have a very diverse and multicultural game within our country in Australia. We should be embracing that. It's been our history. And it certainly will be part of our future. I love James Johnson's passion. I probably question why you would put yourself in that particular situation, knowing that you're going to be heckled.
A couple of points to make from me on this. I think one of the things that frustrates a lot of people is the double standards at play. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, boys, but on Sunday there was a stabbing, sad to say, at a community rugby league game in Sydney on Sunday. Now, I'm going to be fascinated to see if that becomes a rugby league issue in the same way that what happened last week was automatically translated into a football or soccer issue. Somehow, I doubt it. And that is where the inconsistency kicks in. And I think that's what frustrates and angers an awful lot of football people. Secondly, the other thing I would say is I think there was a fair bit of inconsistency in that particular radio interview. Some of the arguments put forward were not correct. The assumption was is that the Lowy family were kicked out of football. That is not strictly true. Frank Lowy had to stand down as per constitution in 2015. And yep. Stephen, his son, who succeeded him, quit in 2018. Nobody kicked anybody out. Stephen could have stood again had he wanted to, but he didn't. And that's fair enough. But for this particular presenter to be saying, why would you kick these people out? These are... you know, successful business people. Well, of course they are. But these issues are not black and white. And anybody who is involved in football understands that. These were very complex governance issues. And unfortunately, we see people who do not have backgrounds in football, who don't have any passion for the sport and very little knowledge of it, proffering opinions that are based on just that, opinions. Rather than facts. The other thing I'd like to say is there's a certain irony that at the weekend, Premier League clubs instigate a social media ban to protest against abuse of players, particularly racial, while here we're still talking about too much ethnicity in the game. Goodness me. It's time we moved on from all that. Let's move on this podcast to the A-League action at Cooper's Stadium on Friday, guys. Two red cards in the goalless draw between Adelaide and Western United. But the big talking point, and I've been very vocal about this on Twitter this weekend, was, again, the VAR denying Dylan Piraeus with what seems like a legitimate winner by squiggly lines, the margins of which are millimetres, Spider.
Yeah, look, I think I said put a bomb in it about 2 months ago, the VAR. And mate, yeah, seriously, we're giving it too much airtime as well, the VAR. Mate, I've said it before, they're not listening. Why can't they just listen to what the people want? This is what football is about, what the people want. They don't want it. Get rid of it. It's driving everyone insane. Mm-hmm. And it was a, you know what? The games are getting changed by VAR, by millimetres, and that's not the name of football.
Completely agree. Maury?
Yeah, I totally agree as well. Spides, I mean, unfortunately, it seems to be here for the long term, which disappoints me. You know, once again, we've got to, I mean, if you're going to implement a system, for me, it's like, well, okay, so let's have all the technology, all the camera angles, all the bells and whistles so that the right decision can be made. We don't have that in Australia. And there's other countries that also do not have that, Spides. So, mate, like how can you make the correct decision, and why are you continuing to go with something that there's a doubt? VAR should stop the doubt.
There is a suggestion, guys, that in Holland, the Eredivisie has instigated a system which actually ignores FIFA rules on VAR. They are giving a margin of error on the assistant ref's calls on the offsides to avoid what we now label the armpit offside call, which is ludicrous in itself. The Dutch league has 5-centimeter wide lines on the screen rather than the razor thin ones that are in use in the Premier League and in the A-League. And if the lines touch, then VAR doesn't intervene. It's rather similar to the cricket system on the LBWs. I think that's a better system. Give a margin of error, at least, if we're going to use this thing.
100%. I think Maury mentioned it a couple of weeks ago as well. Maury, you're ahead of your time, buddy. But and it's great. That's something that'll actually make things clearer. I still think we don't need it. And like Maury says, we actually were the first ones to start using it as well. So we can be the first ones to get rid of it as well.
Yeah, but Spides, we're looking at, in our game, right? People want to be entertained. How do you entertain them? It's by seeing goals, right? And I know back in the day, it was like advantage to the attacking player. Mate, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you're talking, you know, a toenail or millimetres or an armpit. Like, come on, guys. Like,
we're trying to find ways, aren't we, to rub out goals, which shouldn't really be the aim of the game. And just on that, Maury, one of the things that we lost in that Piraeus goal that was disallowed was the through ball from Alessandro Diamante, which is arguably, for me, would have been the assist of the season. What a ball from a player who is just still head and shoulders for me above most in this league. And yet that's rubbed out.
Yeah, you know what happens, Simon? You get to a stage in your football career as a mature, experienced player where the brain doesn't stop. The quality that Diamante has is unbelievable. His intelligence to play the killer ball, that execution. Okay, maybe he doesn't have the legs, but what a wonderful pass, Spider.
Yeah, now it's quality. And again, the VAR is ruining the moments in matches like this. Why people are coming to the games to watch quality players like this. And I tell you, like for Roods, for example, we're talking about Western United, we're talking about Diamante as well. Mate, I think he's not working on things like that every week at training because he knows he's got the best passer of the ball, him and probably Ninkovic, in the league. So his players are running into spaces because they know this genius will find him, and VAR is ruining all this shit.
Couldn't agree more. Let's talk about some of the positives. Sydney Derby on Saturday, a cracking game, a 20,000 crowd. I bet there won't be too many stories written about that, as opposed to the 990 that turned up to watch Western United and the Newcastle Jets. And talking to those experienced players, Maury, Scotty McDonald again showing why he's still a top striker.
Yeah, I still struggle to understand how probably one of the smallest men on the pitch can get a header. Yeah, that's the game. But you know what? It was a cracking game. It was a great advertisement for what we do have on offer. I thought the fans, I thought the atmosphere was fantastic. I thought the quality of the game was actually very good. Derbies, they don't come much bigger. But Western Sydney Wanderers, Spider, what a massive, massive result.
I tell you, Maury, the derby couldn't have come at a better time for them. They were feeling the heat. They got beat by Victory the week before. They've been quite ordinary with getting results, and the derby was the spark that they needed, and they lived up to it. They stood up, they were counted. I thought they were very, very good. I thought Sydney had some good chances as well. They probably had the better chances, but Wanderers deserved it. Yeah. No, but mate, it's a derby. That's what the Sydney derby brings. No other code in the world can give you that. And mate, well done to both sets of fans, both players. Everything was fantastic. It was a great promo for the game.
Sure was. Spider, going to stick with you. Not a lot to write home about in the Perth nil, MacArthur nil game, but a word of praise for Liam Reddy, who's just achieved an A-League record for the number of shutouts. And strangely enough, that's Glory's first clean sheet of the season as well.
I tell you, Rocket is like a fine bottle of wine, isn't he? He's just getting better with every year that he's playing. I think he's been outstanding since he's been at Perth. Considering he didn't even start the beginning of the season, well, you know, that soon they soon found out they needed him back in goals, and he's been fantastic since then. But you know what? It's funny. We were talking about Perth having so much firepower, and they can't really score. But it wasn't from lack of efforts this match. They had more than enough chances to win that game. They just didn't take it, and they're struggling. They're languishing down the bottom of the table for that reason.
Talking of a team struggling for goals, Maura, your old club Brisbane Roar drawing 0-0 with Wellington as well. Makes you wonder why they were willing to let Scott McDonald go.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, I know there was obviously some stuff that went on, clearly.
Yeah, we touched on that. And it probably doesn't help that, like I said, Scotty Mac moves and then scores a winner in a Sydney derby, especially when Brisbane aren't scoring goals. But look, Brisbane are doing okay. They're hovering in the top finals, top six position, but a bit of work still to do, a bit to play out. You know, I just with this squad, I just feel as if there's a bit of an undercurrent of people actually being happy within the football club.
There's a rumor that Jamie Young might want to leave as well.
I read that story as well, and I don't know whether there's any truth to that, Simon, or not. But Jamie Young's been there forever, an unbelievable professional, a wonderful person. And the story that I read was that he was looking for opportunities elsewhere. So I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing, but.
Macaulay Gillespie still to sign a new deal as well. Elsewhere, Melbourne Victory 1, Central Coast Mariners 1. Guys, we're in the first week of May. We're recording this the 3rd of May. Still no announcement of any TV deal. Are you concerned about that?
Very worrying. Very, very worrying, especially when we know that everyone is waiting for this. The game is waiting for this.
Oh, that's it. Sorry, I thought you were about to go into a big rant there, Spider.
No, I don't know anymore what to say, guys. Yeah. I really don't know anymore what to say. Like, I mean, I don't want to keep repeating myself week in, week out on the show, but it's worrying times. And yeah. I'm lost for words anymore because I don't know anything. We're not hearing anything. No one's telling us anything. So it's worrying.
Fingers crossed. Let's hear some announcements soon.
Yes. Hopefully this week or next, we shall see. Spider, last one. I'm going to ask you this one because this is an interesting one and you've got a sort of a little bit of personal experience in this without wishing to delve into the personal details of it. But the story written by Vince Rogari in the Herald regarding the Australian consortium looking to try and buy Bohemians Prague. This is a club, of course, in the Czech Republic that does have some links to football in Australia via a tour many, many years ago. And they have a kangaroo emblem on their club logo. This is led by John Didelitzer, apparently, to look to try and provide some pathways for Australian players. This, of course, has been tried at Zante. It's still ongoing. Is this the way forward for players? And why aren't these consortiums investing in the game in this country?
Look, I still think it's a fantastic idea. The idea is not the problem. It's the end product that is the problem. If these clubs are smart enough to get good young players out of Australia without paying too big of a price for them, their ongoing selling price in Europe is going to be much, much more for these clubs than what they can get getting them out of Australia. So I don't think the idea is wrong. I think the execution is wrong.
Yeah, you're spot on, Spides. But the hardest thing is, you know what it's like, because you've been through the experience at Zante, yeah? You're in Croatia now, so you've got an understanding. You get an Australian investor or any kind of investor that's not local, right? The opportunities for those younger players, they may be there, but the support of the local community is not there. So it's not as easy. An Australian investor gets involved with a club in Europe, and all of a sudden, all the Australian players are going to flood in. It doesn't work like that. If that's your business plan, it's very naive.
Yeah.
I couldn't have said it better, to be honest. I think that's probably a good summing up. I mean, we sometimes in this country jump up and down when we see foreign investors come and take over our clubs and think, well, why are they bringing in, for example, the Newcastle Jets brought in a player from China, Adelaide United brought in a player from China because that was a partner club. And yet we're seemingly okay when it's Aussies going overseas doing exactly the same thing. There's a little bit of double standards in there, isn't there? Anyway, it's an interesting story. We'll see how that one develops. Thanks for the moment, guys. Let's head overseas. London Calling.
London Calling.
Go further with the Australian College of Physical Education. With more than 100 years of experience, ACPE's courses are designed to get you career ready. Their bachelor degrees in sports performance and business, health science, applied fitness.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Education and dance can help turn your dream into a career. Find out where ACPE can take you. Apply online today for Semester 1, 2021 at acpe.edu.au.
Well, before we talk about the Premier League, let's just briefly reflect upon the Champions League semi-finals first legs, which took place last week. We could be set, Maury, for an all-English final. Chelsea in the box seat against Real Madrid, and Manchester City producing a quite brilliant second-half display to defeat Paris Saint-Germain. Can the two Premier League clubs finish the job off, do you think?
Yeah, it's looking as if it's every possibility. But I tell you what, the PSG Man City game, wasn't that a game of two halves? I couldn't believe how good PSG were. You know, Neymar was flying, Di Maria was showing bits and pieces, and Mbappe was lively. And then all of a sudden, the second half, Man City just turned the screw. Don't get me wrong, PSG will be really disappointed with the two goals that they lost. And Spidey, you might be able to comment being a goalkeeper, saying that he couldn't do anything with the second. But every chance, not only in Champions League, but also Europa, that we could be looking at full English breakfast.
a greasy spoon for the Champions League final. Spider, let's ask you about the Europa League. That could be an all-English final as well. Manchester United and Arsenal. United in particular look to be in the final already. Arsenal have got a bit to do.
No, United are in the final already. No chance in the world, mate. They're the best away team in Europe at the moment, and they've got a four-goal buffer. What chance have they got of going out? But the other tie is interesting because, mate, Villarreal's a good side. I don't know. Arsenal seem to be better away from home, and that's still an open tie. Very interesting. Very interesting tie. I reckon it could be a Villarreal Manchester United final. But
massive goal, Spoids. Massive goal though for Arsenal away.
Huge. But all four games, Champions League and Europa League, three are still alive. One's dead and buried.
Yeah.
Two domestic matters in England, and the big story on Sunday, of course, was the fan protest by the Manchester United supporters against the Glazers, calling for them to leave the club, supported tacitly, maybe even overtly, by Gary Neville, former United legend, forcing more either postponement of the big game between United and Liverpool at Old Trafford. Is this going to run and run, this saga, not just with United, but with some of the other clubs as well? We've seen protests at Arsenal, protests at Chelsea, protests at Tottenham.
Yeah, there is a real problem brewing, I think, here in the UK, Simon, that there was a bad taste about, obviously, the Super League. Some fans, I don't think, will ever forgive the owners in terms of the hand that they tried to play and were unsuccessful. We were expecting a peaceful protest today at Old Trafford. Unfortunately, it turned sour in terms of there was some violence, and unfortunately, the news have been following throughout the day. A policeman was glassed. Again, these kind of things are not great. The fans broke into the stadium. So, look, there's real unrest and real disgust about the whole play for the Super League. And the owners, to be fair, I think they're really struggling in terms of the push is going to continue to come from the fans. They don't want them. Mm-hmm. They really don't want them.
They've completely misread the room, haven't they, unfortunately, on all of this.
Massively.
On the pitch, a pretty good week for City. Obviously, they won the Carabao Cup final. They won in Paris and defeated Crystal Palace. Sergio Aguero is still showing he's got that goal touch. Where do you think he'll end up, Spider? He's leaving City at the end of the season.
Will he go back to Argentina?
It's possible, yeah. There's talk of Everton being interested.
Boca? Was it Boca?
No, he was... he was Independiente, wasn't he, to start off with?
Yeah.
I'd have to research that.
But you know what? It'd be strange if another club in the Premier League doesn't pick him up, because he's still got serious quality. And especially one of these clubs that are involved with the Europa League and Champions League, they play a million matches a year, so they need a deep squad, and he'd be perfect. And let's be honest, these players can't play all the games.
No chance he's going to another English Premier League club.
No,
nah.
Why do you say that, Big Chops?
Well, to be fair, his salary is actually quite pricey, for one. And I think he'll show some loyalty in terms of he won't play for another Premiership team that will compete against Man City. He's achieved everything, hopefully, at that football club. Champions League still alive for him. I can't see him playing for another Premier League club.
It was Independiente, incidentally, his first club back in Argentina. So maybe that's a possibility. I mentioned that Everton were interested in signing him. Goodness me, Everton have missed some chances to get into the top four this season. Their home form has been awful, and they lost again to Aston Villa at the weekend. Carlo Ancelotti must be tearing his hair out.
But I still think he's had a good season. I know they're not going to make the top four. But I still think he's done a great job. Everton is not a team that fills the Champions League spot every year. And to get so close must have given their supporters so much joy this year. They might drop short. Ancelotti will be very shrewd with his recruiting with one or two players, like an Aguero, and make him a little bit stronger.
We'll see what happens. Tottenham, easy winners over Sheffield United. Gareth Bale on song again. But a couple of their managerial targets after the departure of Jose Mourinho, Mori, have gone by the wayside. Julian Nagelsmann, of course, has gone to Bayern Munich. Brendan Rodgers, it seems, has ruled himself out, although that could yet change. Erik ten Hag has signed a new deal with Ajax. Who goes to White Hart Lane?
They're going to take their time, that's for sure, as you touched on there. Ralf Rangnick, the German, there's a bit of a, successful German flavour that the UK, England have experienced. It's a tough one. Scotty Parker, obviously no chance because, he's had his challenges and battles, obviously, with Fulham, although I think he's a great up-and-coming young manager. Very, very interesting about who's going to be the next Tottenham manager. I can only speculate, but I've got zero idea in terms of what they're looking at. It's a really, really interesting one. It's a big job with a lot of expectation, in terms of the next manager, who that's going to be. Can they keep Harry Kane? There's so much that's potentially possible at Tottenham, but if they don't get the right person, then I think they'll lose some players and some top players.
Yeah, they're a club in transition at the moment. And another name, Eddie Howe, apparently is about to take over from Neil Lennon at the end of the season at Celtic, Morey. Is that what you're hearing too?
I've touched on it. I've been working the radio up here, Simon, and Eddie Howe for the last 4 to 6 weeks has been the talk of the town, but there's been no statements, there's been no comment. At the same time, every single job that comes up in the UK, Eddie Howe is linked to. So, I mean, I don't know, for Celtic or for Celtic supporters, they will want a head coach that's committed and that wants to be the head coach of Celtic Football Club. And I just don't get that feeling. I get the feeling that Eddie Howe is potentially playing the field, playing the market. And, yeah, it'd be very interesting. He'll be a good choice, a good option for Celtic because he played an entertaining brand of football at Bournemouth. But how long? How long before he makes a call or Celtic make a call to say this is a time frame you've got to make a decision?
Mm. It's got to happen soon, hasn't it? Let's finish off with this one, Spider. A bit of a downer, but reading the tragic story of Diego Maradona's death and the tale that the care that was offered to the Argentine legend was tragically deficient and reckless. That's the description in the media. One of the papers saying that he started dying 12 hours before he passed away. This is very, very sad, isn't it, for such a legend of the game. Died in an apartment on his own in Buenos Aires. There's almost sort of an inevitability about Maradona's end in some ways, but it appears that this is not quite the end of the tale, and maybe some people are going to be held accountable for it.
Yeah, very, very sad when I seen that news to think that he had a chance to survive. Mm. And the way that he passed, very sad news.
Tragic. All right. Thanks, guys. We're going to head off to our final segment. And we got another fantastic guest waiting for us in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Well, our guest today was born in Darwin in 1964, but began his career with Canberra City in 1983 via the AIS. From there, he played for Sydney City, Marconi Stallions, and then went to Belgium to play for Club Brugge, where he won the Golden Boot in 1990. He had stints in Italy with Bari, in England with Notts County, in France with Strasbourg and Lille, before ending his career back in Australia with the Brisbane Strikers and Marconi. He played for Australia 37 times, scoring 11 goals. He was player coach of the Strikers, head coach of the Roar, Sydney FC, the Fijian national team, and the Socceroos for 7 years. He is, of course, Frank Farina. How are you, Frank?
Thanks, Simon. Yeah, no, I'm very well, thank you. And obviously in esteemed company here, so feeling good on this public holiday.
He's lying already. He's already started lying.
Frank, how does a kid with Indigenous heritage from Darwin forge a career that takes him to Europe and beyond?
Yeah, pretty interesting. No one knew about the Indigenous background, you know, and obviously with a name like Farina, who would have thought, you know? But yeah, it was there, and I think back in the day, I hate to say that, but you know, it was very different. You know, I lived in Papua New Guinea until 1976 after independence in 1975. So came to Australia, and the net wasn't so wide then. So, you know, coming from North Queensland, there wasn't a lot of opportunities. And yeah, fortunately, you know, a gentleman by the name of Ronnie Smith came across me at a school's championship and obviously saw something in this little sort of black log fella. And offered me a scholarship at the AIS, which, that was the starting point. And that was the start of the journey, I guess.
So it's all down to Ronnie Smith. do you remember your debut for Canberra? Now, I've researched this. I hope this is correct. I think it was at Hindmarsh Stadium, March 1983, against Adelaide City, and you scored in a 2-2 draw. Am I right?
Yeah, you're actually correct. You've done your homework, Simon.
I do my best.
Yeah, I mean, now that you tell me, yes, that would have been my debut, definitely.
Yeah. Do you remember it at all?
I do remember scoring. I don't remember how, but yes, I don't remember much of the game. It's, you know, it's a bit of a time ago, but yeah, it was obviously a very exciting time for me. I was only a young fellow then, coming out of the AIS, and yeah, it was a big stage for me at that time.
In 1985, you went to Sydney City. So you, all of a sudden, you're playing alongside John Cosmina, Steve O'Connor, Murray Barnes, Jerry Gomez, under the late, great Eddie Thompson. And you reached the grand final in your first season there, losing to Brunswick.
Yeah, it was the old, I think, North and South championships then. And we won the Northern Division and then had to play off against Brunswick in the grand final, as to so to speak. But yeah, that journey to Sydney City, I left Canberra in 84 and I was in the national team, or had been selected in the national squad at the time. And Frank Arrick wanted me to go to St. George, God rest his soul, as well. And I remember on a phone call, he said to me, "Oh, you should come here, son." You know, I can't do his accent, but he goes, "Otherwise you'll never play for Australia again." So, and Eddie Thompson, being the Scotsman that he was, he said, "Don't worry about that." He said, "Frank's just all wind. He'll forgive you and you'll play again for Australia." And so I signed for Sydney City, who were a great side at the time. And I ended up playing for Australia again. So Frank did forgive me ultimately.
They were a great side, Sydney City. And then Frank Lowy suddenly pulled the plug on the club. Was that a bit of a shock? I imagine it must have been.
It wasn't such a shock to me, because I had a meeting with Frank, Eddie, and Andrew Lederer prior to it, and they told me that what was going to happen. And don't worry, they got, I think, about $35,000 from Marconi for me at the time, which was quite a big transfer fee in Australia. And so I actually left prior to the season starting, and I played with Marconi that year, and Sydney City played one game, I think, against St. George, and then they pulled the pin. But, you know, they still got their transfer fee for me, so that was all right for them.
Frankie, is there any truth? I believe there is, because I think we've had this conversation. You're at Sydney City. You've got a chance of a sign-on fee or shares in Westfield?
You've been telling stories, Craig. Yes, but that is true. It's a true story. When I signed, I had a signing on fee, and, you know, without disclosing amounts, I remember sitting in a room, and, you know, I was offered, you know, each year, so it was a 2-year deal, and each year I'd get a signing on fee, and I was offered, but we don't really need to mention names, but I guess everyone will know who, that I get paid half of my signing on fee in Westfield shares and the other in normal cash. And I remember leaving the meeting, and they told me, not, you know, I could decide and whatever. And Eddie Thompson, Tomo, said to me, he goes, "So what do you think, son?" You know, he said, "I think it's a good deal." And I said, "Tomo, I don't know anything about shares." And I said, what's Westfield? I don't even know what that is. So yeah, the story is true. Needless to say, one of my greatest mistakes of my career.
What was the price then, Frankie? And what's the price now?
Oh, look, I don't even look back that far. I tell my partner now that, you know, that story, and she actually worked for News Limited at the time, and she said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Well, let's see you see it at the moment."
Oh, dear. Frank, you said you signed for Marconi. That was probably where your career started to really take off. You'd been successful already, but you won two Golden Boots with the Stallions, won the NSL title in 1988 against Sydney United, and that sort of catapulted you into the overseas market, didn't it?
It did. I guess I'd gone overseas at the end of 87 season, I think it was, and Roda at the time in Holland were wanting to sign me. Jelka, one of your old clubs, I believe. And I think Han Berger was the... I know Rob Barn was the coach then. And his assistant at the time was another national coach. I just can't remember his name, the Dutchman.
Verbeek.
Yes. No, it wasn't Pim. It was the, I think...
Ademos?
No, who was the coach? One of our coaches we had here with the national team. Not Pim.
Verschlaan?
The Slayin. Yes, yes. He was Rob Barnes' assistant at the time. And for whatever reason, there was a journalist by the name of Tommy Anderson, who's a great guy. I got along with him really well. He was brokering the deal. This is the days when journalists brokered deals as
you,
well
you
as
think agents. You took wrong career choices, Frank.
Yeah. So Tommy was working for the Daily Mirror, I think, at the time in Sydney. And there was some dastardly deeds going on in the background, and I ended up not signing. So I came back to Australia and Marconi offered me a new deal. And then, yeah, I was approached during the 88 season when we'd played Israel quite a number of times in World Cup qualifiers. And there was an Israeli manager who approached me. And and at the end of the Olympics, I went to Bruges and, signed from there.
Fair to say that was a very, very good move on your behalf. You had a great time with Bruges. And I was researching again, looking at the sort of players you were teammates with. These are names from my childhood, Frankie van der Elst and Jan Koolemans. Your coach was George Lakins, I think at least in the second season. And there was an Aussie there as well in Vlado Bozanovski the first year.
Yeah, that's right. Vlado, he came with me at the time. And if you remember, that transfer sparked a major inquiry in Australian football, the Stewart inquiry and it started basically from those transfer, mine and Vlado's, to Belgium. And that inquiry went on for a long time. A lot of friends lost their friendships over that. I know Eddie Thompson with, the late Michael Cockerell, there was a lot of issues in Australian football then because of that, and that Stewart inquiry went right into details, and people were accused of, backhanders and whatever. And the game changed again in from that front, from that transfer. But you mentioned the great players. Yeah, they were wonderful. It was a wonderful team, Bruges, that I went to. I was lucky as a striker to go to a side that, was a top team. And I thoroughly enjoyed it there. We won trophies, and I think the guys will tell you that your career, it doesn't matter what you earn, what you do, you always look back and look at what you've won. What trophies you've got. It's great to have the money and whatever, but we always remember those great times when you win things.
When you go back to Belgium, not that you can at the moment with COVID, but when you go back to Belgium and to Bruges, do the fans still remember you? Because you were a bit of a cult hero there, really, for the Bruges supporters back in the day.
Oh, I don't know. Well, Paul Oakon sent me a link the other day about the 50 greatest players. The club turned 130 this year, so it's a very, a club steeped rich in history. So he sent me a link saying I was voted 41 out of 50 or something of that. But my son went there about 4 years ago, and his godfather, because my son was born in Belgium, his godfather took him out for dinner and to cafes. And my son said to me, he goes, I couldn't believe it. He said, I didn't pay for anything. He said, his godfather paid for everything. And he said he didn't really, because they gave it to him for nothing because he was with him. So I definitely have to go back.
Yeah. If only for a free lunch. You then became the first Australian. I didn't know this, I have to admit, but you became the first Aussie to play in Serie A for Bari. Which, given your heritage, I would imagine would be a very proud moment for you as well.
You talking the black fella or what?
Well, you've got a bit of everything, Frank.
Yeah, it's amazing when I look back at the tree, the family tree. Mate, I've even got Chinese in me, so I'm on with everyone. I can tell jokes about everyone and get away with it. But yeah, it was, and that, if you remember, the Serie A then was only the three foreigner rule, because the Bosman ruling hadn't come in or was just coming in, but it was three foreigners and three could play. And in hindsight, it was most probably a bad decision for me. I decided to sign. We played Milan, AC Milan, one of your old teams, against Jelko in the Champions League. The Champions League was a different format then as well, and we got knocked out. And in the final minute, I did my knee. Just a meniscus, and there were three clubs, Verona, Bologna and Bari, who were interested. And as soon as I did my knee, I needed an operation, arthroscopy, and Barry were the only one that stayed in, and they wanted me to sign a pre-contract, and they, paid money up front, and I was lying in a hospital bed, so I signed, and it's probably in hindsight it wasn't a great idea, and it turned out that way. The season wasn't great. I left after about 8-9 games because with the three foreigner rule, the Brazilian guy, João Paulo, broke his leg, which was a ball I passed through to him, and he went one-on-one with the keeper and broke his leg against Torino. So I was real popular down south. And he was replaced with Zvon Boban, who was coming on loan from Milan, so that he couldn't come until the window. And then they sacked the coach, and Zibi Boniek became coach of Bari, and Boniek agreed to come as long as he could bring Robert Jani, the Croatian left back. And obviously David Platt wasn't going to make way, and it was Boban hadn't even arrived. And so it was me to make way. And unfortunately I was frozen out for the rest of that season.
You were the odd one out. So correct. From there, you go to Notts County under Neil Warnock, which is an interesting move.
What a character, mate. He's still around as well. Yeah. Champion guy. He, we played Liverpool. I think we needed to win three of our last four games, and we played Liverpool away at Anfield, and he's given us the big speech beforehand and, talking about what we've got to do and we need to do this and blah, blah, blah. And, if we can just hold him for the first 20 minutes, he was giving it the big, big drum. And anyway, 20 minutes in, we're 4-0 down. So it ended up 4-0. And at halftime, Neil Warnock, he's come in, he's had his car keys in his hand. And he said, without going into all the verbal, he was just abusing everyone. And then I did. And then he looked at me and he said, you're like you're on Bondi Beach feeding the fucking seagulls. And I was looking, 4-0 down, the ball's down the our end all the time. I'm standing up there like a seagull. And he said, you see these keys? He says, I won't be here when you get back in from the second half. I'm going home now. So needless to say, the week after we played Coventry, I think, at home and drew, and there were still three games to go and we were relegated. And that was the last season before the Premier League started. So we're going down, and fortunately Neil said to me, look, we're paying you money to stay here. We can't stay up now. He said, would you mind breaking the contract? And I said, no problem, because, my wife was pregnant. And I went back and my son was born the next day, so it was most probably a sign.
Fascinating stuff. And then the latest...
And Neil's still around. Jeez.
He is.
Mate, yeah. He's hope for me yet.
I was going to ask you, Frankie, mate, he's still fucking going.
I know. That's what I said, Craig. There's still hope for me yet.
Dear. The next stop on your magical mystery tour, Frank, was France. 2 years you spent there. With Strasbourg and Lille. And again, it's amazing when you do your research on this and you see the quality of player that you're actually playing with. And we know you were a great player, but Franck Leboeuf, Olivier Decour, Remy Gard, who was with Arsenal, they were teammates of yours at Strasbourg. And then when you went to Lille, you played with Antoine Sibierski, who I remember very well from his days with Manchester City. France is a country that not many Aussies go and play in. How did that sort of come about?
Yeah, well, that was my time with Bari. Obviously went to Notts County on loan, and during that time, Strasbourg had expressed an interest. So, after Notts County, I was frozen out. And that was a time of, going to Notts County was quite incredible, because I didn't say that Trevor Francis, I was supposed to go to Sheffield Wednesday. Trevor Francis, I actually went to Sheffield first, and I was on trial with Sheffield, and Trevor Francis had coached in Australia, and he played in Australia with Wollongong, and he wanted me to sign, and we'd agreed on terms and everything, and the representative from Bari, they told me they were going to let me go, and I'll cut it really short, and they basically stabbed me in the back. And from there, that's when I went to Notts County on loan. But at Sheffield Wednesday, there was one Eric Cantona, who was also on on loan with Sheffield, but not playing, but he was on trial. And I remember going with Trevor the night they picked me up from the airport, and we went to the Sheffield Arena. There was an indoor tournament going on, and Sheffield Wednesday had a team in it, and Eric was playing. And I'll never forget Trevor saying to me, he goes, "Oh, he looks like a good player, but he's a Tanner ball player. He needs his own ball to play in." Anyway, he didn't end up signing him. And I was in a nightclub with Eric, and I didn't speak French. He didn't speak Italian or English. And he was, you know, he's a big man. And he, through his interpreter, the guy that was with him, he was saying, I don't think they like me. I don't think I'm going to sign, blah, blah, blah. And he ended up signing with Leeds. So I think Trevor most probably would never admit to saying that, but he missed one good one there.
Wow. That's a great story.
Oh, it's a very good one.
So after your stint in Europe comes to an end, you come back to Australia in 1995 with the Strikers, and you lead them to their finest hour in 1997. Oh,
you're just trying to make Zelko cry now. You can't do that.
The NSL Grand Final, 1997. You win 2-0 against Sydney United. You score, and you score past a certain Zelko Kalats in the Sydney United goal. Yeah, talk us through it, Frank.
They were a good side. Look, seriously, they were a good side. And you look at the names in that team at that time, and you know, there's a who's who of Australian football, and that club was producing great players. And look, we had experienced players, and yeah, I managed to score past Zelko, but he knows and I know that if I'd actually hit it the way I would like to have hit it, he would have just picked it up with one of his big mitts and it wouldn't have been a problem. But I think I shocked the shit out of him. It was a knee shin toe. It came off everything and came through bodies and just trickled into the corner.
But I still remember it clearly as well, Frankie. Clear as day, mate.
Well, now you know I'm being totally honest. It was one of those ones in a final. And, you know, we went into the game knowing that they were a very good side. We ended up playing each other, I think, five times that season. And, you know, it ended up that final game was the decider, and we ended up winning three out of the five. But, you know, they were a very good side, worthy premiers, and you know, in my view, worthy champions, because I still believe first past the post is the most consistent team. But you know, it was a great time for Brisbane, and obviously Sydney and I are producing all those players. But yeah, it was an interesting grand final, and you know, we went into the game knowing that, you know, they scored a lot of goals, and the key for them, I thought at the time, was, you know, using the analogy, the head of a snake. You know, they had Milicic, Drilic, and Marisic, who Marisic was a creator, and they'd scored a lot of goals. And I thought, well, if we can cut the head off the snake, we've got a chance here. And I had two experienced defenders in Alan Hunt and Danny Wright, who, you know, I felt could handle the two, and Milicic and Drilic. And then Marisic was the key. So I pulled Glenn Gwynn, who was a central defender, come sweeper, and I had to leave out Gary Phillips, who was a good friend and a, you know, great stalwart of football, out of the team. And I just, Gwynny was mobile, he was quick and good defender, and I just put him on Marisic, and it seemed to work, and we got the win. So it was a, you know, wonderful time, not just for myself, I think, but for Queensland football.
But Frankie, correct me, you were player coach then.
Yeah, that was a fatal mistake as well. It, you know, how it came about doesn't matter, but you know, your first time as player coach, and we win the title. So I thought I was, you know, 6 foot tall, bulletproof, and I was a genius. And then the next year, then I realized this coaching gig ain't so simple, you know, but it couldn't be done today. And I think it was just a one-off. That one season, I was 2 years player coach, but the second season I didn't play much. And that year, we just had a good blend of youth and experience, and it you know, it worked out. We finished second in the league, but you know, as Australia is, it's one game, and you know, a good side can have a bad day, and that's what Sydney United had that day.
Worked
you
out.
Bullied us.
Worked out very well for you, Frank. And in 1998, which is only a year after that title win, all of a sudden you're the national team coach. Now,
99, I think it was.
Was it
99? I went to Marconi for a year, yeah.
My apologies. But I want to ask you about the appointment as Socceroos coach, because now I wasn't in Australia at the time, but from the stuff that I've read and that I've learned, is it fair to say there was a bit of opposition to your appointments? Because there seemed to be three or four different candidates.
Mate, I'll tell you honestly, I don't know if anyone's ever really let the true story be told. It was pure politics. It's as simple as that. I think there was myself, Ange Postecoglou, Eddie Krencevic, I think, was also in the mix, and David Mitchell. And without going in and telling too many stories, one day I will tell the total thing, but we all had interviews at the Travelodge at just beside the airport. I don't know if it's the Travelodge anymore. It's not definitely not the Travelodge, but we all had interviews there, and there was a lot of backward and forward going with deals being done by board members. And as I said, I don't want to mention names now, but if we get this one and you can have this, we'll put so-and-so here. It was like shuffling, you know, the deck around everywhere. And I wasn't going to get the job because there was a lot of opposition. And I sort of knew that. But then politics raised its ugly head and deals were done, and all of a sudden I became the national coach. So it was, and that might sound a little bit vague because that's the way I want to leave it, because one day hopefully I will, you know, get to tell the real story and the real truth of that appointment, but also the ensuing five and a half year reign. It's probably the most hostile times in Australian football. And in that 6 years that I was national coach, I think I had seven CEOs and seven presidents.
Wow.
not a great sign for stability, I guess.
Extraordinary. Let's touch upon one or two of those highs and lows on the pitch. Failure to qualify for the World Cup in 2002, the two-legged defeat against Uruguay in 2001, Tony Vidmar famously in tears on the pitch at the end. Was that your worst moment in the job?
It was probably the saddest moment. Saddest. It's a word that you can use loosely, I guess. But I felt we had a great side, and you know that side progressed on, and you know I don't think I've ever seen an Australian team with that much talent that we had. When I say team, I'm not talking just to 11 players. I'm talking to, you know, the 30 players we had to choose from. You know, we were rich in every area, and unfortunately, it came down to, as it did in 2006, two games over a four year cycle. So, you know, unfortunately, in that final lead up to those games, you know, Tony Popovich was struggling with a foot injury, and there was, you know, that whole story there has another tale of its own, and I'm sure Tony would be happy to you know, go on about that. But you know, I had to make a decision. You know, we won the first leg at home, and it was always going to be close, irrespective of what was said after the game. We needed to win by more. That's a very easy thing to say. We 1-0 with Kevin Muscat penalty. It was a solid performance, and we'd never won at that stage in terms of a World Cup qualifier in Australia. So, you know, if someone would have said to me before the game, you're going to win, I would have signed it for it. And I think all the players would have signed for it. 1-0, we were criticised for not winning by more. You know, we're playing Uruguay. And if you really go through the game in Uruguay, we were in that game until, you know, right till the death. And until that third goal went in, we were in that game. And we had chances. Yeah. So, you know, it was one of those things. And, you know, I was slaughtered after. Sorry, Craig. Yeah.
No, Frankie, obviously I played that game, and obviously you've got to face the early onslaught, which we knew was going to happen. We conceded a goal, which wasn't great, but Dukes had a great chance, didn't he, really, to, I think it was at 2-0, we were 2-0 down, but Dukes had a great chance, which would have put us in an unbelievable position.
Yeah, 100%. And even, I think, Emma went through early on in that first half, and, you know, later on, Harry had a chance, you know, chested left foot volley from all but 10, 10 yards out and, you know, went over the bar. And I think when Agostino might have come on, had a decent chance, or Skoko. So we had our chances in a furnace. I mean, you played there. You know, you've both been there. It's a hostile environment. But we were by no means beaten badly. It was just one of those things. And you both played at the levels where you – it's small things in football. You know, you sneak one of those goals – and we're going to France. To Japan, Korea. So it was one of those things. And, you know, was it a down moment for me? Yes, because I thought it was a wonderful opportunity. You know, in hindsight, could I have, you know, Murph came in for Popovich, which I thought was just a clear swap, and he'd done so well for us in the past. Could I put Tony Vidmar there? That's another thing, which, you know, most probably was an option. But no, I would go with what we did, because I thought that we were right in the game until the death. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be, but it was a great indicator for 4 years to come. And the report that I had to put into the FA, the SWOT analysis about that campaign, which I've still got and happy to give to you guys if you're ever interested in reading what I said about that campaign. All of those things that I put in the report came to fruition in that 2006 campaign in terms of lobbying for the away game first, because no one's going to tell me that Uruguay weren't getting their preferences in terms of where the first game was played. The arrival at the airport, I suggested we should have had a private charter, which I pushed for in that 2001 year, but we didn't have the money. And, you know, the FA were broke, let's be brutally honest, and we did it as best we could in terms of what budget they had. So all those recommendations were put into place because, you know, one Frank Lowy, a powerful man, managed to get things which I think helped us qualify 2006.
Sure did. Yeah. let's move on to a more positive note. The win over England in 2003, yes, it was only a friendly game, but made a lot of headlines at the time. We do have a Twitter question as well from Chris Hockman. How did it feel when you're leading England and they substitute the entire team at half time? But that's not to take away from what you did that day. That must have been a wonderful night for you and the team.
Oh, yeah, without doubt. It was fantastic. And that the game came about because we hadn't played for such a long time. And Ian Knopp, who was the president at the time, he said to me, oh, I've got some good news and some bad news. And he said, gave me the bad news, which was something other than the England. He said, the good news is we're playing England. And I said, geez, okay, that's great news. in England, then. So, you know, it was fantastic. And I knew that the players would be up for it because they were all wanting to play for Australia. There was no doubt about that. And we the game was all set. You know, it was sponsored by Forex, I think, for that particular game, because money was still an issue. And I can tell you a few boys like that sponsor, but we won't go into that. And So that was the game which also changed that substitution rule within FIFA, because after that game, FIFA changed the rules to, and it was that particular game that they decided that was only six substitutions from there for friendly internationals. And I think that still stands today. I'm not sure, but it was a wonderful, wonderful night, wonderful time. And we thoroughly deserved the win. You know, if you look at the game again, we played extremely well, and you know, we were most probably set back a little bit by their substitutions at halftime. So, but overall, it was, you know, wonderful, wonderful memory.
In 2005, Frank, you're replaced by Husinink by the Federation at the end of the Confed Cup of that year. With the World Cup around the corner, that must have been a very difficult pill to swallow, even though you'd lost all three games at the Confed Cup. The thing that I remember at the time is that you could have probably come out and had your say in the media as to what had gone on, but you never did. You never spoke out either against the Federation or against Husinink or anybody else involved in the game, which I thought, and this is only my personal opinion, showed admirable restraint and respect on your behalf.
Yeah, look, there was no need to, Simon. You know, one day it may all come out, the truth of what happened, and I know the truth. But I had 6 years as national coach, and, you know, most probably the fresh start was maybe what was needed. And in the end, you'd have to say and argue that it was, because we qualified. So there's no point going back and saying, was it the right thing? Because there was two games to go, I think. Well, four games. We had to beat Solomon Islands, I think, home and away, which we were going to do. And even that became a bit of a struggle. And then the Uruguay game. So, no, for me at that time, disappointed wasn't the word. It might sound really stupid, but in some ways it was relief. It was like you don't realise the storm you're in life a lot of times until you actually step outside of it. And so 6 years, I had a fair crack, you know, and we missed qualification 2002. And I knew Frank, and I had meetings with him at his house and whatever. And we could not afford to fail. Without going into all details, we could not afford not to qualify. And you know, Frank at that stage could not afford, because he'd come back into the game. So he was going to do everything possible. There was no guarantees, but that he could say, well, I've done everything that, you know, to make it that we can qualify. And I respected that. And that appointment from Hiddink, you know, that was making sure that he put everything in place that no one could say that, well, we didn't do enough or we didn't do everything possible. So there was absolutely no bitterness from me. It's, you know, people might say it's easy for you to say now, but there wasn't. I had a fair crack, and 6 years was a long time as national coach, and very turbulent times, as I said, but I will never have bad things to say about a game that has given me so much. And, you know, there's always good and bad. You've got to take it, and then I think be respectful at the same time.
Frankie, I know you well, because I've worked with you also at Clubland, and obviously your loyalty for me is admirable. We've got an unbelievable relationship through that. You touch on politics in terms of getting the job. Was there politics in terms of you losing your job?
100%. There definitely was. I mean, leading to the Confeds Cup, you know, I was instructed to pick certain players. And we were in the, I think, Craven, oh, we were at, what's it, Chelsea Village.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a lot of things happening, a lot of people getting invited to go to Holland because there was a World Youth Cup, I think, happening at the same time. And John O'Neill was the new CEO. And John was a great guy, great CEO. He was, you know, he was a bully. And I think you have to be when you're in those roles. And I'm not saying it was from John, but it was from the highest of highest that, you know, I was instructed basically who to pick and who to, you know, who to put in the squad to go. And I refused pretty much point blank and said, whilst I'm the national coach, you know, as far as I know, you know, I'm the one who selects the team, rightly or wrongly. If we fail, then that's on my head. And so I knew there was a storm brewing, and, you know, that was well before the Confeds Cup, and it was within my own group as well in terms of, you know, staff. And, you know, that there was some turmoil for other reasons. So, again, I can't go into it, Craig. And, you know,
mate, your book's going to be unbelievable.
So, yeah, it there was a lot of politics involved in that. And unfortunately, you know, the previous Confederations Cup, which you were at, where we did it, you know, ever so well, we weren't disgraced in Germany. We lost 4-3 to Germany. I didn't think that was a real disgrace. You know, 4-2 to Argentina. And, you know, the third game against Tunisia, you know, I changed the squad and gave a few boys, you know, a run. We had no chance of making it. So I sort of knew after that it was, that storm was turning into, you know, a hurricane. And that, when we got back to Australia, everything I sort of believed came to fruition.
It's fascinating stuff, Frank. I want to finish off, because we've been going quite some time, with a couple of Twitter questions, if you don't mind. This first one from Nick Rojas, who asks, this might be a tough question to answer, but how do you look back on your time with Sydney. Of course, you went on to coach in the A-League after the national team with both Brisbane and Sydney. Nick asks, what were your thoughts on how the fans viewed you in your last months at the club?
Yeah, look, the fans are the life base of any club, you know. And, you know, I came into Sydney to do a specific role. It was, you know, the year I came in, I had two seasons, if you like, but the first season I came in after 10 games. I think Ian Crook resigned, and that was the year of, you know, the signing of Del Piero. The Spider was there. We had to – look, I'm going to be brutally honest. We needed to clear out some stuff in the club. That's why the club was in the situation it was in. You know, and I'm not saying that we're talking about bad players or this or that, but there was time for some to move and need to be, you know, start afresh. And that two-year period was pretty much what was happening. You know, trying to move people on, you know, get rid of some contracts which were not going well. The club wasn't going well, and, you know, unfortunately I was the person in charge, and I took that opportunity knowing full well what I was getting into. And, you know, the fans were upset about it, but what I will say is that, you know, after that second year when we made the playoffs, we missed the, you know, getting into the grand final, but that would have been a big ask. Yeah, just, but it would have been a big ask. And, you know, the next year was really when you could start the whole rebuilding process, which it did, and then Sydney went on to some great years.
Frankie, really, really quick question. Marquee that puts bums on seats or marquee player that can win you a title?
Marquee player that can win you a title every day of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Del Piero, and we got to say, Frankie, mate, I was there with you. And I think the years you were at Sydney, I thought you'd done a remarkable job. And you won't say it because you were the manager, but man, we had a bang average squad, bang average. And what we did was very, very good. And the way you got treated was harsh. But we had Del Piero there who actually put a lot of bums on seats. And man, he was a great player, but he left us vulnerable in a lot of positions.
Yeah. And he was a great man. I mean, you know, Spider, he was a great guy, you know, very humble in a lot of ways, but you know, like I said, where, you know, we talk about, you know, transition in football. And for me, it's, you know, we talk about defending and attacking. It's as simple as that. When, you know, we tend to try and make the game more difficult than it is. It's about simply about defending and attacking. You can talk about transition and all that. That's fine. But when we were defending, you know, as much as I like Ali and respect him and what he's achieved, we were defending with 10 men. And In no league in the world can you do that, let alone Australia. When we're in possession, yes, 30 metres from goal, he could make things happen. But it was tough times, and we had to adapt to that. And, you know, unfortunately, the A-League had progressed into a pretty good physical style of a game. And if you don't defend with 11 players, you're going to struggle. And we did. We had a roller coaster, some weeks good, some weeks bad. And that was the reality.
Frank, this might be an apocryphal story, but I was told once that you did ask politely Alessandro whether he would mind tracking back, and he gave you pretty short shrift. Is that right?
No, well, he told me a story about if I had a dog, and I said, yeah, I have a dog. And he said, well, you know, I go to the park and throw the tennis ball, the dog goes and gets it and brings it back. Because when I lose the ball, it's like that, you know. They bring it back to me and then we start again.
Mate, I remember that year, Frankie. We tried all sorts of systems to try to hold the pocket, just to hide him somewhere. Mate, we tried everything.
Well, that's what he said to me. He said, oh, you know, in a meeting, he said, you know, sometimes I'm on the left, on the right, in the middle. And I said, Ali, we're moving around because teams, wherever you are, they're coming down. So we move you, you know. That's when he gave me the story about the dog and the tennis ball, you know, and I'm giving the Benny Hill looks all around. But we had some great times, you know, with when he was calling for the ambulance with Abbas, Ali Abbas, and Ali's yelling out in Italian, call an ambulance, because he was having a bit of a run-in with Ali Abbas in the dressing room. And I remember Anthony Crea the pocket rocket, turn around and say, Ali, just be quiet because the ambulance will be for you. You know, what, he knows martial arts or something. So we had some funny times.
Frank, we could talk for hours. I've got one more question for you, and this is our question of the week. $100 Outback Steakhouse voucher going to Lee Brock some facts. And I think this is a good one, actually. What needs to improve for strikers not scoring in the A-League in general? Is it technique? Is it the mental side? Or is it just coaching? I like that.
Yeah. Chances would be another one in there. You know, give them enough chances, they'll score. But, yeah, look, I think coaching, you can't coach a striker. It's a gift. They have a natural talent of putting the ball in the back of the net. But, you know... You can coach strikers into, especially young ones, into, you know, I put it into three categories for strikers: movement, runs, and finishing. Finishing is a gift, but you can get them into situations about, do they place the ball? Do they dink it in these situations, or do they just hammer it? So those categories, I think, in terms of young players, if you look at coaching, that's what you can coach them into, giving them ideas of, you know, movement. No defender likes someone who's just continually moving around. So giving them an idea of where to move, you know, and then runs, where, how do you make runs? So, and then finishing. So those are the three areas. So I guess to answer in a nutshell, coaching, I don't think there's enough specific striker coaching. There's, you know, we have specific goalkeeping coaching, but in terms of specific strikers coaching, that's the areas I'd be focusing on in terms of you know, trying to teach good habits to young players.
It's a good question, good answer. Frank, before we let you go, are you done with coaching? I know you're working, I think, with a school at the moment, or would you still like to get back into coaching ideally?
Oh, I'd love to, you know, and if the right opportunity came up. You know, the game is in trouble in this country at the moment. I'm sorry, I've got to say that. You know, I've recently resigned from MacArthur, nothing to do with anything other than I had an opportunity to start up something else. But, they're traveling really well for their first season. But, you know, I'll say it to you guys because I've worked with all of you, but the game is in trouble in Australia. I don't care what anyone says. I think Jamie Johnson's doing a great job. He's got a big job ahead of him. You know, our focus is obviously the 23 Women's World Cup, but, you know, our game is in trouble, and we've got to try and do as much as we can to help it out.
We all agree with you, Frankie. We know there's a lot of hard work to be done in our game, a lot of uncertainty, which is not fantastic. But we're in a really, really tough place, and unless we make some serious decisions and get good leadership, our game's not going forward.
No, and it just shows in the players, Craig, at the moment. I talk about the luxury I had of coaching a national team with what I believe, you know, a number of you guys will go down as the greats of our game. I'm not saying, I'm not pissing in your pockets or anything, but it's true. And I often speak the truth, and that's all I try to do. But where are the players coming from now? You know, with no disrespect to our national team, we're our stars. We have good players, but we don't have the Moores, the Kalaches, the Vidukas, the Ocons. I could spend 5 minutes just naming names. The Kules, everything. It's crazy. Where are these players now? And that is an indictment on our system. And, you know, I'm sitting on a committee, and we're an advisory committee. But, you know, we all realize that we're trying to do what we can, but it's a tough gig all around, I think, in terms of where we are at the moment in the game.
Spider, 100%. you get the final word with your weekly question. Go on.
Mate, Frankie, mate, the best stadium you've ever played at and the biggest dungeon you've ever played at.
Well, I think, you know, the best stadium that I played it in terms of pure atmosphere was the Azteca Stadium in Mexico City. As a young player, the opening game of the 83 Youth World Cup. In terms of noise, deafening, and on the pitch, that would, you know, most probably be the stadium that I would remember most being young and, you know, having been influenced by. The worst one, I would have to say, most probably Green Gully down in Melbourne.
Oh, it was on the side. Not bad, Frank.
This is back in the day when it was built. I don't know if it's still like that, Green Gully, I apologise, but back in the day, it was on the side of a hill, which was a dump, a former dump site. And I swear on my life, he used to run on this field and there'd be bits of tin cans and spoons and knives from rubbish that was still coming up out of the grass. You didn't want to fall down because you'd get cut or something. So that was not high up on my memories, Spider.
Not bad.
Absolutely brilliant, Frank. We could talk for hours, but we've gone on probably long enough for this podcast. All that remains, Frank, is for us to say thank you so much for joining us today. Some wonderful memories, and I don't know about everybody else. I'm pretty sure most people would agree. I think you've still got an awful lot to offer football in this country, and hopefully those skills and that experience is not going to be wasted. So thank you so much, mate, for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Frankie. Cheers, mate.
That is Frank Farina, and that is us for this week. Join us again next week for more Shim Spider and so much more. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.